Olá e hello. My name is Teresa and I'm the host of Os Ouvidos Também Comem. If you are an English-speaking listener, I kindly ask you to stay tuned. After a short introduction in Portuguese, I'll switch back to English. Não é engano, estão mesmo a ouvir Os Ouvidos Também Comem, mas este vai ser um episódio especial. É o último desta segunda temporada e a entrevista está gravada em inglês porque a minha convidada vive em Londres há muitos anos. Falo de Kimberly Espinel, food blogger, food photographer e autora do The Little Plantation. Se me seguem no Instagram, sabem que eu sou fã do trabalho da Kimberly. Costumo participar no seu desafio Eat, Capture, Share e até já fiz uma formação online com esta incrível criadora de conteúdos. Em janeiro, sai o seu livro Creative Food Photography: How to Create Exceptional Images of Food, e é sobre isso e muito mais que vamos conversar logo a seguir a uma curta introdução em inglês. In this special episode, I talk with Kimberly Espinel, the creative soul behind The Little Plantation, one of my favorite Instagram accounts and one of the food content creators I admire most. She's launching her book, Creative Food Photography, How to Create Exceptional Images of Food, this January, and throughout this conversation, she will share some behind the scenes of this process with us, she will give tips and lots of information about photography, Instagram, and so much more. Let's listen in. Hello, Kimberly, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I am so excited to chat with you today.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to have you here in what is the first episode of Os Ouvidos Também Comem in English. And by the way, may I take the opportunity to explain the name of my podcast? In Portuguese, we have a very popular expression, which means almost the same as we eat with our eyes first. To refer to the importance of the appearance of the food. And for the podcast, I switched eyes to ears, turning it into we eat with our ears too. So thank you for accepting my invitation. It's really an honor to have you as a guest, especially because your podcast, Eat, Capture, Share, was a great inspiration for me to create Os Ouvidos Também Comem. Before I ask you to introduce yourself, I would like to know if you have ever been in Portugal.
Teresa, you don't know this. I have been, for me, Portugal is my second home. In my
really?
Heart is my, yes. And I've been there lots and lots of times. And that is because my stepfather, and who's the father who, I call him stepfather because he's not my biological father, but he's the father that raised me. He is from Portugal.
Oh, he's from I didn't know that.
Yes, he's from Chaves. And
the northern part of
in
Portugal.
The north. Yes. But, you know, all his brothers and sisters and his mom, who now passed, they lived in Lisbon and then also kind of the outskirts of Lisbon. So every summer, you know, when I was a child, we would go to Portugal. I love Portugal. I've been there. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I imagine you know a lot of Portuguese dishes. Do you have a favorite Portuguese dish?
Yeah, well, you know, there's things that we always ate that if I eat that just, you know, whether it's my favorite dish, I don't know, but it's like it evokes memories. Yeah. So caldo verde, for example.
Traditional soup.
Yes. Like when I was a kid, I didn't love it. But now
normal.
When I eat
it's
it,
normal.
But now when I eat it, it feels like home. Like it feels very familiar. It feels very comforting. And so I would say probably that.
Great. I think most of my listeners know you and follow you on Instagram, but I'd like you to introduce yourself.
Okay. Right. So my name is Kimberly Espinel. I'm a food photographer and stylist. I'm also a podcaster, as you said. My podcast is called Eat, Capture, Share. And Eat, Capture, Share is also the name of my Instagram food photography challenge. So yeah, that's me. I live in London. I'm married. I have a son. And I do a lot of food photography for clients. And then also I teach food photography and styling.
Mm-hmm. You entered this world of food photography by being a prop stylist. Could you tell us how this opportunity arose and what does a prop stylist do?
Yes. So I would say my first step into, you know, the world of food photography was actually, I started as a food blogger. And so I started by creating recipes, plant-based recipes, vegan recipes, healthier recipes. And I did that really as a passion project. So I was working somewhere completely different. And in that process, I'm not quite sure how, but I started getting emails first for sponsored content and then more and more work as a prop stylist and a food stylist. And so what a prop stylist does is it is their job to source all the backdrops, all the plates, all the cutlery, all the glasses, everything and anything you would need to create a scene. And so I got quite a few jobs doing that. And then I got quite a few jobs doing prop and food styling. So where you're responsible for both the props and then also for all the food styling things. And it kind of evolved from there until eventually now my main work is actually food photography.
Mm-hmm. And what about food stylists? What is a food stylist supposed to do? Because I got the impression that the tasks of a food stylist varies a little bit from country to country. And I think that many times food styling and composition is somehow understood to be the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I think it really, so here in London where I'm based, what a food stylist does really depends on the project. So for example, if you have a big project like a big cookbook shoot, sometimes what you'll have is you'll have a prop stylist, as I mentioned, so somebody who's responsible to get all the backdrops, everything, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have what we call here a home economist, and that is the person who actually goes out and buys the food and sometimes even prepares the food. And then you have a food stylist. And sometimes the food stylist literally just does the styling. That's very rare. But usually nowadays, the food stylist would do the buying of the ingredients, the preparation, and okay, the styling. And as budgets are shrinking, a lot of the times food stylists now also have to do the prop styling. So it kind of depends. You know, if you have somebody like a Jamie Oliver or Nigella mm-hmm. Lawson, because their budgets for their books are quite big, there will be more people mm-hmm. doing more specialized things. And if you have maybe a smaller, lesser known cookbook author, then they only have budget for one person and that person has to go and do the shopping, find the props, prepare the food, style it. So it kind of depends on that.
Yes, I think that most food content creators are both prop stylist, food stylist, and photographer. Do you think it's possible to, is it possible to master all these areas well?
I think it is. I think what's really important is that you know where your strengths lie and lean into that, and that you also recognize where your weaknesses are, and then either hire out for that or train really hard to bring those up to par. And I really think each of those are very, very different skill set actually, you know. So you know, that the photographer is really somebody who has the bigger picture view. So about how all these different pieces of the props, the food styling, and the final photo, how it all comes together. And so they carry a lot of responsibility. And sometimes you also doing the food styling and the food preparation and going out to buy the ingredients actually distracts you from creating the best possible photo possible. But, you know, as I mentioned, sometimes with budgets or if we're doing things for ourselves, then we have to step into all of these roles. But I generally work as part of a team, and I think I find that really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And within photography itself, what do you think is the most difficult part to learn and train? Photographic technique, camera settings, equipment, and that stuff, composition, or editing?
I think everybody probably has something that they're naturally more gifted towards. Personally, I think that, you know, learning exposure triangle and learning camera basics are something that most everybody will pick up quite quickly, because it's very technical, and there is a right and wrong, and you can see that in the photo if you've overexposed or underexposed. But I think things like composition really are very, there's a lot of intuition there, there's a lot of feeling there, and then there's also a lot of you finding your own aesthetic and your own style. Mm-hmm. And that is not as concrete as ISO and shutter speed, right? So it's much more abstract and much more, you know, hard.
Difficult.
In a way difficult, because it's we have to tune into our heart. We cannot follow a script. You know, we have to tune into something deeper. And then editing, I think editing is two things. One is yes, it's technique and technical. So you do need to understand that. But it's also a lot to do with having good taste and knowing what is beautiful and knowing what is not beautiful, and enjoying that. Some people love that part of the process, you know? So I think maybe composition out of those three, perhaps most people struggle with, but I think it's very individual.
Mm-hmm. And what is the part of this process that gives you the most pleasure?
I love food styling, and I love composition, because I feel it is the most creative part. I think it's the most creative part. Mm-hmm. And also think it plays to my strengths. So it's something that I find easier. But saying that, like right now, I'm really digging deeper into my editing, and I'm really enjoying that. But generally, you know, the hands, doing things with my hands, mm-hmm. and you know, doing things that I can touch and feel and see come together, I love that the most. Mm-hmm. I think
your book, which we can already pre-order and will be available at the beginning of January, is called Creative Food Photography: How to Capture Exceptional Images of Food, and will teach us a lot of these subjects. Could you share with us two or three super effective tips to improve our photography that afterwards we can find in the book in a more detailed way?
Yes. So number one is understanding and studying light. And I think there's one level of doing that. So, you know, side light, back light, mm-hmm. all those things, right? And then there is the next level. And I think a lot of the photographers that you love, that I love, their understanding of light is the next level, is more about color, tone, intensity, reading shadows, reading light points, playing with that. And really, that's something that I spend a lot of time in the book in, to just give give the reader touch points, mm-hmm. and guidance into how they can deepen their light study. And the second thing that the book explores in a lot of detail is, how do we find our own unique style? How do we balance being inspired by somebody else and then actually finding our own unique voice? And, you know, through the book, I talk through a couple of exercises that you can do to use inspiration, but then make it your own. And also highlight some stumbling blocks as to why we sometimes imitate other people's styles, and you know, why that happens, and how we can move away from that to find our true, unique signature look.
Great. I'm so looking forward to getting my eyes in your book. I'm sure it will be a great success. And I know that bringing this book to life has been a tough and challenging journey. What was the most important lesson you've learned since you've started this adventure?
Yes, I think so. I really had hoped when I started my book writing process, I had hoped, in fact, I was convinced, I was certain that I was going to get a book deal. Mm-hmm. That is what I worked towards. So I worked 6 months on my book proposal. I did the best proposal that I could, and I didn't get a book deal. And so that really forced me to kind of look and think, okay, so why do I actually want to do this book? Now that I haven't got the book deal, do I still want to do this? Is this what we call in English a vanity project? So is this just something for my ego? Is this just an ego boost? I want to write a book and I have to write a book. Or is there a particular reason why I'm doing this? You know, like, is there a bigger purpose, a bigger thing in this? And identifying why I wanted to do a book was actually really, really important to be able to pull it through, because it is very time consuming. It is financially a big investment. and also, you know, at the end of it, you might not succeed. So does any of that matter? Potentially, all those things are such big reasons that make you stop going ahead. But I knew exactly why I wanted to do that. And that really allowed me to pull through. So that would be my big takeaway, to really, really be clear if a book is something that you want to do, why you want to do it. Like, what is the purpose? How does it fit into your business, to your place in the world, all the things. So that was really, really an important lesson for me.
For me, it's unbelievable that you couldn't get a deal with a publisher. I can't understand that.
You know, but what that does, Teresa, when you get, so I would say I send it off to like maybe 20 publishers and maybe another 20 agents. And there was one agent who was interested, I have to say, and she was mm-hmm. very nice, actually. But what that then does is, if they say no, and a lot of the times the reason they said no was that they didn't believe that anybody would go out and buy a book on food photography. And yes, that's what they said. There I was like, okay, these are people who have worked in publishing for 50 years. They know the book market. They understand. If 50 of them tell me that there's no place for this book, who am I? Who am I to say you're wrong? You know? So I had a lot of time that I needed to spend on analyzing, were they right? And if they're not right, what makes me think that they are not right? And I didn't think.
I understand.
Yeah. So, and the other thing is, you know, now that I've done it, I also understand why they said no, because producing a book like mine, which is hardback, like a cookbook, right? Like a hardback, mm-hmm. lots of photos, the production and the printing is very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. And so for it to be worth their while, they have to sell at least 5,000 to 10,000 copies. And the thing is that the vast majority of books don't sell more than 300 copies. That's, okay. You know, that's the average book sale in the world.
I didn't know that.
Yes, very low. So if they're going to spend and they have to sell at least 5,000, they're just going to be like, you know, we don't think there's enough people who would buy that book for us to get our investment back. So, you know, I now understand, but I still believe that there are 5,000 people in the world who want to buy this book.
Yes, I believe that too. Are there any mishaps or tricky situations about the making of the book you would like to share with us?
Yes. So for one, I did my book proposal. I did everything. I wrapped it all up and put a bow on it, as they say. And then I was a little bit stuck. I didn't quite know, like, okay, now I don't have a book deal. Like, what do I do next? What do I do next? And for a couple of months, I actually didn't do anything because I didn't know, where do I find a printer? How do I distribute the book? How do I design the book? What font should I choose? You know, so many questions that I didn't know. And what I then did is I hired somebody who, her name is Fiona, and to kind of help me push the book to the next level. And in that process, actually, we spent a whole day together and looked at the book that I had and, you know, explored, who's this book actually for? Like, who's mm-hmm. going to read this? And in that process, we threw out 50% of the book. So 50% of the book I got rid of, because when I looked at it, and sometimes you need another person to bounce ideas off, to reflect, to go, oh my gosh, I hadn't thought of that. You're so right. Oh, and so we threw away 50%. I had to rewrite that whole thing. We together, she helped me find a book designer. We found an editor and also a proofreader and the printer. And so I think that was really it, kind of recognizing that I had gotten to the limits of what I can do as an individual and, you know, investing in professionals who could help me make this book from good to very good and from not quite ready to, you know, ready to ship. So that was a really big stumbling block that, you know, I sat on for lots of months, but once I hired that person, that was kind of, you know, the impetus I needed to take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm. You are also an Instagram expert. Are you still a fan of the platform despite the continuous changes within the algorithm, which gradually decrease the reach and overall performance of our posts and stories?
Oh, Teresa, this, we could be talking about Instagram for another hour.
Yes.
So, you know, I was just actually writing my newsletter about this, and I'd say, yes, I still love Instagram. And yes, I still think it is a really important platform. And no, I don't see myself leaving the platform anytime soon. However, I don't love it as much as I used to. And it's not actually reach or engagement that I'm so concerned about, because I think sometimes getting all the likes, or better said, sometimes I have photos that get lots of likes. And then at the end of the day, I feel really good. I feel amazing. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, but actually, I didn't move the needle in my business. Like, nothing happened. I just got lots of likes to boost my ego. That's all it did. Yeah. And I'm not always sure that that is healthy. And the same way, if I have a photo that doesn't perform well, it's not the end of the world. Like, I know I'm a good photographer, you know.
Yes.
But
sometimes the photos that we like most are not the ones which get more likes.
Exactly. And what does the whole likes thing mean? You know, what does it all mean? So for me, I don't mind that reach is down or that engagement is down. That doesn't bother me so much. What is important to me is that if I spend time on Instagram, I do it with purpose. I do it with focus, and I'm adding value. So if I find, and I have been finding that a lot this year because we had the pandemic and all the, you know, all the things mm-hmm. that were going on, that I was spending a lot of time on Instagram just directionless. And so for me, I really noticed I need, and if I always think, if something is happening to me, usually that means it's happening to other people as well. You know, I'm not unique. I'm just like everybody else. So I don't want that. I need to, when I start my day, I need to feel like I'm doing something that adds value, that makes a difference, or just that makes business sense, right? And so from that perspective, I feel that pulling a little bit away from Instagram feels better for me at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. And what are the most important rules we should follow in order to have a good Instagram account and to be a successful IG food content creator? Mm-hmm.
So I think one is to have a really cohesive and together Instagram look, a branded together look. That you can achieve that through what you photograph, but a really, really key component is to bring your IG feed together in terms of how you work with colors, you know, to have a color palette that you stick to that pulls everything together. That's really, really important. I think the second thing, and I think that's actually a hurdle that a lot of people stumble over, is what are you actually saying? Who are you speaking to? What is the purpose of your Instagram? Are you sharing pretty photos because you want lots of likes? Probably you're not going to get a lot of success. Like there has to be, are you there to inspire? Are you there to share recipes? Are you there to help people who are gluten intolerant bake for the first time in 10 years? Like what is your purpose? Who are you speaking to? Who are you there for? And that needs to be crystal clear, crystal clear. And if it's not, then it's very, very hard to find success on Instagram. And then thirdly is to make use of all the extra and all the little bits and pieces that Instagram has. So you want to find success, use your IGTV, use your IG stories, use your reels, post lots of video content. I think that's really, really key for growth right now.
Thank you. And for those who want to get paid partnerships with brands or get hired for photography work through the Instagram, what are companies and brands looking for? Quality, low price, originality? What do you think?
I always think, but I don't, this is not for me. This is somebody who I love. His name is Seth Godin. He's a marketing guru. Yes. And he always says that there will always be somebody who offers whatever you do cheaper. And he calls it the race to the bottom. Like you never want to be in the race to the bottom. So I'm never really concerned about, am I the cheapest, you know, influencer that they can work with? Like that doesn't, yeah. And I don't think anybody should have that at the forefront of their mind. But actually, it goes back to what I mentioned before, is who is your audience? Who are you serving? Who's following you? Who are you providing content for? And that audience, is that the audience that the brand wants to reach? So for example, you have a blog about weaning children off milk to solids, like that is your blog, and you provide recipes around, you know, weaning type foods. Now, is a 60-year-old man going to follow you? Probably, hopefully not, right? It's going to be moms with young children. Great. So if you have a company that does clothes for toddlers, they're going to want to work with you because your audience overlaps with the audience they're trying to reach. But, you know, this is my point again. If you don't actually know who you're speaking to, if you don't know who you're serving, if you don't know who's in your audience, how are you going to convince Coca-Cola or McDonald's or Nike or whatever brand it is you want to work with to use you to, you know, to sell their product? If your audience is, you know, 10-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 50-year-old, and they all, you know, then it's not worth it for them. So having a really crystal focus on who is in your audience, who you're speaking to, who you're serving, and having that overlap with what the brand wants, that's a really, really good place to start.
Thank you, Kimberly. There is a lot of talk about the importance of our images having a unique style, and I often find myself thinking that my style is not having a style, and I came to the conclusion that this comes from my fear often unconscious of copycatting and doing the same someone else has already done. And I think it's a trauma that has to do with my background in advertising, where we have to be very careful not to create campaigns whose concepts had already been used. And on the other hand, I think it's because I like and identify myself with a lot of styles and don't want to get attached to anyone in particular. Could you give us some practical advice to be able to find our photographic identity without it becoming boring?
So, you know, I think one of the misconceptions around finding your style means that once you identify your style, that that is the style you have to have for the next 25 years of your career. And that is simply not true. You know, finding your style means identifying your unique take, your unique, you know, way of photographing, capturing food today, and allowing that to be the best it can be for today, tomorrow, the next couple of months. And then you reassess, and then you rejig, and it's like, oh, you know, I really like this, or, you know, I'm not feeling this color palette. I want to edit a little bit darker or moodier. And then you evolve. And, you know, if we think about artist, I think I used this once as an example in the challenge. You know, if you think about people like Pablo Picasso, if you think about Van Gogh, if you look at their very first paintings, and then you look at the paintings at the height of their career towards the end of their lives, they're completely different. Their styles completely evolved. And I think that's okay. But I also think it's really important in the process of finding your style to always check in. Do I like this? Do I not like this? Is this, am I scared to express what I really want to express, to style the way I really want to style? Am I just doing the same thing again and again because it feels safe? So a constant self-inquiry. You know, like, we don't often do that, but that is a really important part, and you know, of the process, if that makes sense.
Yes, I'm struggling with that.
But my other question would be, if you are fearful, or my other suggestion would be, if you are fearful of copying, how about stepping onto Instagram, posting your photo, and then stepping away without scrolling, so that you're not taking in other people's content, and see how you go.
Okay. Great tip. Thank you. General speaking, there are visual trends to which no photographer is immune. What do you think are the main trends in food photography for the coming months, whether in terms of colors, mood, type of food? Tell us what you foresee.
Yes. So for the last couple of years, actually, already, I feel there is a lot of harsh light, a lot of harsh light that is very, very trendy, that a lot of people are doing, and that looks really, really cool and edgy. And I don't think that's going away. I feel that people are editing warmer and warmer tones, and that there's more of that compared to when, you know, I stepped onto Instagram for the first time. It was cool, Linda Lomelino style, you know, cool. I think we're moving into warmer. I think there's still a lot of, there's an insatiable desire to see very stylized lifestyle type photos, you know, with stage, with flowers, and, you know, a lot of extra things. There is a lot of that, that people just are not bored of. They love it. And I think dark and moody, maybe also because of the pandemic and what have you, but that's still a trend that is not moving away, and people still love that very, very much. So those are a couple of things that I've noticed and that I think are here to stay for a little while longer.
Okay, thank you. I know you don't use artificial lighting. How in the winter, for example, can you get around the limitations of natural light and continue to produce good work?
So I have a nice big window, and there's like a field in front of my window so that, you know, there's no obstruction. Get a lot of light flow in. That helps a lot. And of course, my tripod, I would not be able to do the work that I do without it, because having that means that I can really bring my shutter speed down and allow lots and lots of light in. And then also, I'm very, so if I know I'm doing a shoot, then, and I'm in the Northern Hemisphere, so my light window, I think, is even shorter than yours. But if I plan a shoot, then I really make the most of the hours that I have. So if I know I have light from 9 to 3, then I will shoot all the way through that period and get the most out of it. So that's how I've always done it. Mm-hmm.
But do you think, do you plan to try artificial light someday?
Yeah, I used it in the book. There's a couple of photos that I shot with artificial light. And just because of some other bits and pieces that I'll be doing in 2021, I will be getting some artificial light. Mm-hmm. But I really love natural light. I really love it. And I love the challenge of the unpredictability. And I really like it. I really like it.
Mm-hmm. So Kimberly, since I have you here, I wanted to take the opportunity to get to know you a little better and ask you about some preferences.
Okay.
What is your favorite meal?
Pizza.
Pizza. When I asked this, I was thinking about breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Breakfast.
My English, I'm sorry.
Breakfast, 100% breakfast.
Yeah. What do you eat for breakfast?
I mean, on a day-to-day, it's super boring. It's usually almond milk with a muesli or a Bertram muesli or a smoothie in the summer. I usually make homemade juice every morning. So it's always that. Mm-hmm. But on the weekends, we have like toast or homemade waffles or pancakes. And I just love the idea. I just love the idea of breakfast. I love it. I love when we go to a really fancy hotel and then have breakfast.
Yes. It's the best of it.
It's just toast and orange juice, but it's the best toast and orange juice. I love it. And I love that you can have something sweet for breakfast if you want to. I love breakfast.
Pizza for dinner. Yes.
Pizza, definitely, yes.
And you are vegan, yes?
Yeah, I'm plant-based. Mm-hmm.
How do you make the pizza yummy with no cheese?
Oh my God, it's yummy. It is yummy.
Yes?
Listen, because pizza essentially...
What are your tricks?
But listen, pizza is bread. So bread is already good. We're already starting off on the right foot. There's like a nice, and I love a sourdough pizza. So nice thin crust, a good tomato base. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. And then I usually put some herbs on it or some butternut squash or some pine nuts. Honestly, it is so good. And the other thing I find, not having cheese on it means it's not so heavy. Mm-hmm. You know, like you don't feel so... It's good. Honestly, it's good.
Mm-hmm. With no guilty.
With no cheese, no.
And what is the ingredient you can't even smell?
Well, I don't know if I can smell it, but the one food I have never, ever, ever liked, and I still don't like it, is Brussels sprouts.
Oh, I loved
it. Oh, no. No.
Oh, no. And they are so, so beautiful. And what is the ingredient you always have in the fridge or in your pantry?
There's a couple of things we always have. We always have garlic. We always have onions. We always have lemon and lime. We always have olive oil. Those are standard, like always. Mm-hmm.
So good. And my last question for you is, what will your dinner be this evening? Pizza?
No. No, I think we're having lentils, actually. I think it's lentils and rice and like a carrot salad thing. So, yeah, like it's perfect for this kind of very cold, wintry weather.
Very well. So before we say goodbye, I'd like you to tell us where we can find you and know more about your work, your book, where we can buy it.
So the best place to connect with me is via my blog, thelittleplantation.co.uk, and links to pre-ordering my book are there. And also it includes, if you pre-order, there's a playbook, a pre-order bonus playbook that you get. For that, you need to join the mailing list. And the mailing list is the other really, really good place to connect with me. And then my podcast, Eat, Capture, Share. Please listen in. Totally make my day. And then I'm on Instagram, The Little Plantation.
Are you in TikTok?
No. No.
What do you think about it?
I think it's happening. I think it's happening. And I really think it's happening. And I think if you like video, if you're already doing Reels and if you're already doing IGTV, I would repurpose that and put it on TikTok. I think TikTok's happening for sure. For sure.
Thank you, Kimberly. It was a pleasure to have you here. And I take the opportunity to wish you a Merry Christmas and a wonderful 2021.
Thank you so much. It was a joy to speak with you, and I want to wish you and your family a fantastic festive period too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So this was the 27th episode of my podcast, but it's the only one in English. If you understand Portuguese, I invite you to listen to the other interviews. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I wish you a Merry Christmas, since this episode is going to be released on December 23rd. Thank you for listening. E agora chegou a vez de me despedir em português. Espero que tenham gostado da minha conversa com a Kimberly. Nas notas do episódio encontram os links para o seu blog, The Little Plantation, bem como para a sua conta de Instagram e para a página onde podem encontrar o seu livro em pré-venda. Os ouvidos também comem, vão fazer uma pausa, mas até à próxima temporada podem ouvir os episódios em falta e partilhá-los com os vossos amigos foodies, food bloggers ou food photographers. Obrigada por estarem desse lado e Feliz Natal!